Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. As for what this meant in the long run, John had no crystal ball. However, he knew from history that empires do not endure and that the pendulum always swings in both directions. From his perspective, men like Roldos offered hope. He was certain that Ecuador's new president understood many of the subtleties of the current situation. John knew that Roldos had been a Torrijos admirer and had applauded Carter for his courageous stand on the Panama Canal issue. John felt certain that Roldos would not falter. John could only hope that his fortitude would light a candle for the leaders of other countries who needed the type of inspiration Roldos and Torrijos could provide. Early in 1981, the Roldos administration formally presented his new hydrocarbons law to the Ecuadorian Congress. If implemented, it would reform the country's relationship to oil companies. By many standards, it was considered revolutionary and even radical. It certainly aimed to change the way business was conducted. Its influence would stretch far beyond Ecuador into much of Latin America and throughout the world. The oil companies reacted predictably. They pulled out all the stops. Their public relations people went to work to vilify Jaime Roldos, and their lobbyists swept into Quito and Washington, briefcases full of threats and payoffs. They tried to paint the first democratically elected president of Ecuador in modern times as another Castro. But Roldos would not cave in to intimidation. He responded by denouncing the conspiracy between politics and oil and religion. Although he offered no tangible proof, he openly accused the Summer Institute of Linguistics of colluding with the oil companies and then, in an extremely bold move, he ordered SIL out of the country. Only a week after sending his legislative package to Congress, and a couple of days after expelling the SIL missionaries, Roldos warned all foreign interests, including but not limited to oil companies, that unless they implemented plans that would help Ecuador's people, they would be forced to leave his country. He delivered a major speech at the Atahualpa Olympic Stadium in Quito and then headed off to a small community in southern Ecuador. He died there in a fiery airplane crash on May 24, 1981. The world was shocked. Latin Americans were outraged. Newspapers throughout the hemisphere blazed CIA assassination. In addition to the fact that Washington and the oil companies hated him, many circumstances appeared to support these allegations, and such suspicions were heightened as more facts became known. Nothing was ever proven, but eyewitnesses claimed that Roldos, forewarned about an attempt on his life, had taken precautions, including traveling in two airplanes. At the last moment, it was said, one of his security officers had convinced him to board the decoy plane. It had blown up. Despite world reaction, the news hardly made the U.S. press. Osvaldo Hurtado took over as Ecuador's president. Under the administration, the Summer Institute of Linguistics continued working in Ecuador, and CIL members were granted special visas. By the end of the year, he had launched an ambitious program to increase oil drilling by Texaco and other foreign companies in the Gulf of Guayaquil and the Amazon Basin. Omar Torrijos, in eulogizing Roldos, referred to him as brother. He also confessed to having nightmares about his own assassination. He saw himself dropping from the sky in a gigantic fireball. It was prophetic. John was stunned by Roldos' death, but perhaps he should not have been. He was anything but naive. John knew about Arbenz, Mossadegh, and Allende, and about many other people whose names never made the newspapers or history books, but whose lives were destroyed and sometimes cut short because they stood up to the corporatocracy. Nevertheless, John was shocked. It was just so very blatant. John had concluded, after their phenomenal success in Saudi Arabia, that such wantonly overt actions were things of the past. John thought the jackals had been relegated to zoos. Now he saw that he was wrong. John had no doubt that Roldos' death had not been an accident. It had all the markings of a CIA-orchestrated assassination. He understood that it had been executed so blatantly in order to send a message. The new Reagan administration, complete with its fast-draw Hollywood cowboy image, was the ideal vehicle for delivering such a message. The jackals were back, and they wanted Omar Torrijos and everyone else who might consider joining an anti-corporatocracy crusade to know it. But Torrijos was not buckling. Like Roldos, he refused to be intimidated. He too expelled the Summer Institute of Linguistics. And he adamantly refused to give in to the Reagan administration's demand to renegotiate the Canal Treaty. 2 months after Roldos' death, Omar Torrijos' nightmare came true. He died in a plane crash. It was July 31, 1981. Latin America and the world reeled. Torrijos was known across the globe. He was respected as the man who had forced the United States to relinquish the Panama Canal to its rightful owners and who continued to stand up to Ronald Reagan. He was a champion of human rights, the head of state who had opened his arms to refugees across the political spectrum, including the Shah of Iran, a charismatic voice for social justice who many believed would be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Now he was dead. CIA assassination once again headlined articles and editorials. And we'll return to this after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Graham Greene began his book, Getting to Know the General, the one that grew out of the trip when John met him at the Hotel Panama, with the following paragraph. Quote, in August 1981, my bag was packed for my fifth visit to Panama when the news came to me over the telephone of the death of General Omar Torrijos Herrera, my friend and host. The small plane in which he was flying to a house which he owned at Coclesito in the mountains of Panama had crashed and there was no survivors. A few days later, the voice of his security guard, Sergeant Chuchu, alias Jose de Jesus Martinez, ex-professor of Marxist philosophy at Panama University, professor of mathematics, and a poet, told me, there was a bomb in that plane. I know there was a bomb in that plane, but I can't tell you why over the telephone. End quote. People everywhere around the world mourn the death of this man who had earned a reputation as a defender of the poor and defenseless, and they clamored for Washington to open investigations into CIA activities. However, this was not about to happen. There were men who hated Torrijos, and the list included people with immense power. From what John heard, Torrijos was considered a liability by President Reagan, Vice President Bush, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as by the CEOs of many powerful corporations. The military chiefs were especially incensed by provisions in the Torrijos-Carter Treaty that forced them to close the School of the Americas and the U.S. Southern Command's Tropical Warfare Center. The chiefs thus had a serious problem. Either they had to figure out some way to get around the new treaty, or they needed to find another country that would be willing to harbor these facilities, an unlikely prospect in the closing decades of the 20th century. Of course, there was also another option: dispose of Torrijos and renegotiate the treaty with his successor. Among Torrijos' corporate enemies were the huge multinationals. Most had close ties to U.S. politicians and were involved in exploiting Latin American labor forces and natural resources, oil, lumber, tin, copper, bauxite, and agricultural lands. They included manufacturing firms, communications companies, shipping and transportation conglomerates, and engineering and other technologically oriented corporations. The Bechtel Group, Inc., whose senior officers included George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger, were a prime example of the cozy relationship between private companies and the U.S. government. John knew Bechtel well. Those at Maine often worked closely with the company, and its chief architect became a close personal friend of John's. Bechtel was the United States' most influential engineering and construction company. Many people in high positions at Bechtel despised Torrijos because he brazenly courted a Japanese plan to replace Panama's existing canal with a new, more efficient one. Such a move not only would transfer ownership from the United States to Panama, but would also exclude Bechtel from participating in the most exciting and potentially lucrative engineering project of the century. Torrijos stood up to these men, and he did so with grace, charm, and a wonderful sense of humor. Now he was dead, and he had been replaced by a protege, Manuel Noriega, a man who lacked Torrijos' wit, charisma, and intelligence, and a man who, many suspected, had no chance against the Reagans, Bushes, and Bechtels of the world. John was personally devastated by the tragedy. He spent many hours reflecting on his conversations with Torrijos. Late one night, John sat for a long time staring at Torrijos' photos in a magazine and recalling his first night in Panama, riding in a cab through the rain, stopping before Torrijos' gigantic billboard picture. Omar's ideal is freedom. The missile is not invented that can kill an ideal. The memory of that inscription sent a shudder through John, even as it had on that stormy night. John could not have known back then that Torrijos would collaborate with Carter to return the Panama Canal to the people who rightly deserved to own it, or that this victory along with his attempts to reconcile differences between Latin American socialists and the dictators, would so infuriate the Reagan-Bush administration that it would seek to assassinate him, as testimony to Senate inquiries would later reveal. John could not have known that on another night, Torrijos would be killed during a routine flight in his twin Otter, or that most of the world outside the United States would have no doubt that Torrijos' death at the age of 52 was just one more in a series of CIA assassinations. Had Torrijos lived, he undoubtedly would have sought to quell the growing violence that has plagued so many Central and South American nations. Based on his record, it can be assumed that Torrijos would have tried to work out an arrangement to mitigate international oil company destruction of the Amazon regions of Ecuador, Colombia, and Peru. One result of such action would be the alleviation of the terrible conflicts that Washington refers to as terrorist and drug wars, but which Torrijos would have seen as actions taken by desperate people to protect their families and homes. Most important, John feels certain that Torrijos would have served as a role model for a new generation of leaders in the Americas, Africa, and Asia, something the CIA, the NSA, and the EHMs could not allow. At the time of Torrijos' death, John had not seen Paula for several months. He was dating other women, including Winifred Grant, a young environmental planner he had met at Maine, and whose father happened to be chief architect at Bechtel. Paula was dating a Colombian journalist. They remained friends, but agreed to sever their romantic ties. John struggled with his job as an expert witness, particularly in justifying the Seabrook nuclear power plant. It often seemed as though he had sold out again, slipping back into an old role simply for the sake of money. Winifred was an immense help to him during this period. She was an avowed environmentalist, yet she understood the practical necessities of providing ever-increasing amounts of electricity. She had grown up in the Berkeley area of San Francisco's East Bay and had graduated from UC Berkeley. She was a free thinker whose views on life contrasted with those of John's puritanical parents and of Anne. Their relationship developed. Winifred took a leave of absence from Maine, and together they sailed his boat down the Atlantic coast toward Florida. They took their time, frequently leaving the boat in different ports so he could fly off to provide expert witness testimony. Eventually, they sailed into West Palm Beach, Florida, and rented an apartment. They married, and their daughter Jessica was born on May 17, 1982. John was 36, considerably older than all the other men who hung out in the Lamaze class, and I'll return to the story after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. Part of John's job on the Seabrook case was to convince the New Hampshire Public Service Commission that nuclear power was the best and most economical choice for generating electricity in the state. Unfortunately, the longer he studied the issue, the more he began to doubt the validity of his own arguments. The literature was constantly changing at that time, reflecting a growth in research, and the evidence increasingly indicated that many alternative forms of energy were technically superior and more economical than nuclear power. The balance was also beginning to shift away from the old theory that nuclear power was safe. Serious questions were being raised about the integrity of backup systems, the training of operators, the human tendency to make mistakes, equipment fatigue, and the inadequacy of nuclear waste disposal. John personally became uncomfortable with the position he was expected to take, was paid to take, under oath in what amounted to a court of law. At the same time, John was becoming convinced that some of the emerging technologies offered electricity-generating methods that could actually help the environment. This was particularly true in the area of generating electricity from substances previously considered waste products. One day, John informed his bosses at the New Hampshire Utility Company that he could no longer testify on their behalf. He gave up this very lucrative career and decided to create a company that would move some of the new technologies off the drawing boards and put the theories into practice. Winifred supported him 100%, despite the uncertainties of the venture and the fact that, for the first time in her life, she was now starting a family. Several months after Jessica's birth in 1982, John founded Independent Power Systems, IPS, a company whose mission included developing environmentally beneficial power plants and establishing models to inspire others to do likewise. It was a high-risk business, and most of their competitors eventually failed. However, coincidences came to his rescue. In fact, John was certain that many times someone stepped in to help, that he was being rewarded for his past services and for his commitment to silence. Bruno Zambotti had accepted a high-level position at the Inter-American Development Bank. He agreed to serve on the IPS board and to help finance the fledgling company. They received backing from Bankers Trust, ESI Energy, Prudential Insurance Company, Chadbourne & Park, a major Wall Street law firm in which former U.S. Senator, presidential candidate, and Secretary of State Ed Muskie was a partner, and Riley Stoker Corporation, an engineering firm owned by Ashland Oil Company, which designed and built highly sophisticated and innovative power plant boilers. They even had backing from the U.S. Congress, which singled out IPS for exemption from a specific tax, and in the process gave them a distinct advantage over their competitors. In 1986, IPS and Bechtel simultaneously, but independently of each other, began construction of power plants that used highly innovative, state-of-the-art technologies for burning waste coal without producing acid rain. By the end of the decade, these two plants had revolutionized the utility industry, directly contributing to new national anti-pollution laws by proving once and for all that many so-called waste products actually can be converted into electricity and that coal can be burned without creating acid rain, thereby dispelling long-standing utility company claims to the contrary. John's plan also established that such unproven state-of-the-art technologies could be financed by a small independent company through Wall Street and other conventional means. As an added benefit, the IPS power plant sent vented heat to a 3.5-acre hydroponic greenhouse rather than into cooling ponds or cooling towers. John's role as IPS president gave him an inside track on the energy industry. He dealt with some of the most influential people in the business, lawyers, lobbyists, investment bankers, and high-level executives at the major firms. John also had the advantage of a father-in-law who had spent over 30 years at Bechtel, had risen to the position of chief architect, and now was in charge of building a city in Saudi Arabia, a direct result of the work John had done in the early 1970s during the Saudi Arabian money laundering affair. Winifred grew up near Bechtel's San Francisco World headquarters and was also a member of the corporate family. Her first job after graduating from UC Berkeley was at Bechtel. The energy industry was undergoing major restructuring. The big engineering firms were jockeying to take over, or at least to compete with, the utility companies that previously had enjoyed the privileges of local monopolies. Deregulation was the watchword of the day, and rules changed overnight. Opportunities abounded for ambitious people to take advantage of a situation that baffled the courts and Congress. Industry pundits dubbed it the Wild West of energy era. One casualty of this process was Maine. As Bruno predicted, Mac Hall had lost touch with reality, and no one dared tell him so. Paul Priddy never asserted control, and Maine's management not only failed to take advantage of the changes sweeping the industry, but also made a series of fatal mistakes. Only a few years after Bruno delivered record profits, Maine dropped its EHM role and was in dire financial straits. The partners sold Maine to one of the large engineering and construction firms that had played its cards right. While John had received almost $30 a share for his stock in 1980, the remaining partners settled for less than half that amount, approximately 4 years later. Thus did 100 years of proud service end in humiliation. John was sad to see the company fold, but he felt vindicated that he had gotten out when he did. The Maine name continued under the new ownership for a while, but then it was dropped. The logo that had once carried such weight in countries around the globe fell into oblivion. Maine was one example of a company that did not cope well in the changing atmosphere of the energy industry. At the opposite end of the spectrum was a company that insiders found fascinating, Enron. One of the fastest growing organizations in the business, it seemed to come out of nowhere and immediately began putting together mammoth deals. Most business meetings open with a few moments of idle chatter while the participants settle into their seats, pour themselves cups of coffee, and arrange their papers. In those days, the idle chatter often centered on Enron. No one outside the company could fathom how Enron was able to accomplish such miracles. Those on the inside simply smiled at the rest and kept quiet. Occasionally, when pressed, they talked about new approaches to management, about creative financing, and about their commitment to hiring executives who knew their way through the corridors of power and capitals across the globe. To John, this all sounded like a new version of old EHM techniques. The global empire was marching forward at a rapid pace. For those interested in oil and the international scene, there was another frequently discussed topic, the vice president's son, George W. Bush. His first energy company, Arbusto, Spanish for Bush, was a failure that ultimately was rescued through a 1984 merger with Spectrum 7. Then Spectrum 7 found itself poised at the brink of bankruptcy and was purchased in 1986 by Harkin Energy Corporation. G.W. Bush was retained as a board member and consultant with an annual salary of $120,000. Everyone assumed that having a father who was the U.S. vice president factored into this hiring decision, since the younger Bush's record of accomplishment as an oil executive certainly did not warrant it. It also seemed no coincidence that Harkin took this opportunity to branch out into the international field for the first time in its corporate history and to begin actively searching for oil investments in the Middle East. Vanity Fair magazine reported, "Once Bush took his seat on the board, wonderful things started to happen to Harkin. New investments, unexpected sources of financing, serendipitous drilling rights." In 1989, Amoco was negotiating with the government of Bahrain for offshore drilling rights. Then Vice President Bush was elected president. Shortly thereafter, Michael Amin, a State Department consultant assigned to brief the newly confirmed U.S. ambassadors to Bahrain, Charles Hostler, arranged for meetings between the Bahraini government and Harkin Energy. Suddenly, Amoco was replaced by Harkin. Within a few weeks, the price of Harkin Energy stock increased by over 20% from $4.50 to $5.50 per share. Even seasoned energy people were shocked by what had happened in Bahrain. "I hope GW isn't up to something his father will pay for," said a lawyer friend of John, who specialized in the energy industry and also was a major supporter of the Republican Party. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.